Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with the second half of my fascinating discussion with Randy Fortenberry, holder of the Thomas B. Mick Chair in Agricultural Economics at Washington State University. I'm just as interested in a quick introduction to episode 80 as I was to 79. You don't want to hear me talk about economics. You want to hear about a man who has spent decades in the business of making sense of the growing, trading, hedging, contracting, counting, and data crunching of the world's major agricultural crops. Although Fortenberry cut his economic teeth on corn and soybeans in the Midwest, he was appointed to the Mick Chair in 2011 and now has plenty of experience with soft white wheat. Before I get to the show, an explanation. Through some quirk of fate, I like the phrase catbird seat. Not everybody is familiar with it. It essentially means sitting pretty. Hence my question.
Is it wrong to suggest that soft white wheat is in the catbird seat compared to some other classes of U.S. wheat?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the catbird seat. Soft white wheat producers right now aren't going to tell you that they're really excited about prices. But it is a more stable international market for us because we are unique with that product, whereas some of our other wheat varieties have more direct competition from other potential exporters and or potentially more substitutability with some other wheat variety into the demand centers where they go. So we do tend to get a premium for soft white wheat. In that sense, it's in a catbird seat. Our prices are at a premium to the other wheat varieties, but it's still going to be influenced by those other wheat varieties. So if all prices collapse, soft white wheat is also going to go down. Because at some price level, even the Japanese will decide it's not worth paying for the soft white wheat. We'll substitute for something else and maybe end up with a lower quality or a different consumer product, but we can't pay a premium beyond some level for soft white over any other variety.
Does it concern you at all that soft white is sort of a dessert wheat? It is a wheat that you add sugar to, and right now sugar has a bullseye printed on it.
Yeah, that's a good question. It definitely makes sense to do some of what all the Pacific Northwest Grain Commissions are doing, which is talking to other potential consumers about blending opportunities, getting soft white wheat into other kinds of products, and looking at whether or not there's room to bring soft white wheat as a blend into, you know, the millers in Latin America, for example, and diversify from Asia. So not just diversifying from being basically a dessert wheat product and looking at a broader range of food applications, but also diversifying from Asia as being the primary buyer, because if we had some sort of a economic disaster in Asia, Korea and Japan would both be affected if one of them collapsed, for example. So diversifying geographically makes sense as well.
I receive weekly the crop progress report for the Pacific Northwest during the growing season, and it's interesting to watch the evolution of the crop in real time. But you believe there's something more valuable there. Tell me about your project using the crop progress reports as a means for anticipating production.
Well, what I do with that crop progress report is I do two things. First, I do it for Washington, and I do it for the U.S. So what we're looking at is just winter wheat. But I'm taking those crop progress reports from about the 1st of April through the end of June. They come out weekly. And I have a series of statistical models, a different one for each week, that forecasts final yield. And then I can combine that with USDA's forecast of acres, and I come up with a production number. And that's what I'm using right now to argue, for example, USDA's production of over 1.8 billion bushels for U.S. wheat is too large. I think it's going to be closer to 1.65 or something like that. A lot of people will tell you that report has no information. I disagree with that. And in fact, in order to make sure this was a valid exercise, I actually sent that through a peer-reviewed scientific journal article process. It took a little while because we had to debate back and forth whether there really was statistical validity in what I was doing, that the models were solid, that there really was information there. But in the end, the paper was published. People did buy into that. And so now I'm actually using that on a weekly basis to predict yields. But here's what you can't do. And this is what people do exactly wrong. I heard an economist from North Dakota make this statement at a conference I was at a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't disagree with him more. What he argues is you can't compare this year's crop conditions to last year's. Well, in the statistical model, it uses a long time series. So I disagree with that totally. He's arguing, well, you can't do that because the people filling out the form change. Well, if that's true, then you can't compare any statistical analysis where you take a sample this year to a sample last year, because the sample might be representative, but it's not going to be the exact same individuals. So I disagree with him completely on that. What he does argue is you can compare last week to this week. I actually disagree with that. And this is why. And this is what my statistical analysis has shown. As we go through the production season, it's even more exacerbated for corn than it is for wheat, by the way. What happens is, as you start to get some stress in the field or on the crop, people get less optimistic about what they're going to get. And so we'll see a dip in these crop conditions often in sort of the middle of the production season. When the crop really hasn't deteriorated, people are just concerned because it didn't rain yesterday, or they see a little bit of yellow on the end of a of a leaf or something like that. And they get concerned, and so they that's reflected. So these models I have 13 different ones, each which goes back 12 years, but only uses a specific week to come up with that statistical representation. So I could end up seeing, let's say next week, a dip in the crop conditions report. People aren't quite as optimistic next week as they were last week, and I'll say my yield expectation hasn't changed, because that kind of happens every year. And so I look at them completely different from most people. A lot of people claim they have no value. I actually think they do. If you look last year at my forecasts, I was pretty darn close for Washington. I was within a bushel from my early forecast to the final predicted number that USDA gave us.
So now we were chatting about this just as I was setting up, but you frequently talk about basis, which has always been a difficult concept for me to understand, and which doesn't seem to play much of a role in the Northwest. What am I missing?
It actually plays a huge role in the Northwest. And the reason is we have a lot more basis variation than most other parts of the country.
Explain basis.
Okay, so what basis is the cash price minus the futures price. So, for example, today, the cash price in Pullman for soft white wheat is just over $6, $6.50, I think. The futures price for July delivery, I looked this morning, I think it was $5.35 or $5.40. I don't remember exactly. But if I take that, let's just say $6 and $5.50. If I take the $6 cash price, I subtract the $5.50 futures price, I say our basis is plus 50. We're paying 50 cents more than the futures. The reason basis matters is, what I want to know is, if the futures doesn't change, can I still expect my cash price to improve? That means my basis is getting stronger. So the cash price can still go up relative to the futures. There's a sort of a theoretical maximum about how far that can go, because once it becomes more efficient to import wheat from somewhere else, then we're not going to have basis improvement. Our cash price can't go up more, because we'll start encouraging imports to an area that already has more wheat than it consumes. We export wheat. So what basis helps me understand is, how far could that cash price really go before I have no more opportunity, unless the futures market itself goes up? So when I talk to producers about whether they should sell their wheat at harvest or consider storing it through the year, I'm looking at futures prices for all these different delivery dates on the Chicago Futures Exchange, and I'm calculating, based on history, what I think our cash price can do relative to those deferred futures prices. And if it looks like cash prices don't have much room to move, I'm telling producers, just sell it now. It's going to be really risky to sit on it. You're not going to get much back. If it looks to me like there's really some opportunities, given where the futures is, without a futures rally at all, for cash prices to still improve, then I can tell producers, I think it's less risky to store now, and you might want to consider not selling everything and looking for a later price opportunity.
And what are you thinking about storage now?
Well, I don't think about storage right now. I'll think about it about September.
Okay.
So, but I can tell you, last October, I was telling people I don't think they should store their wheat.
Right. I remember that. So China's data indicates that it has not quite 50% of the world's total wheat carryout, but we don't know whether it actually exists, or if it does, what the quality is. What's your opinion of the data coming out of China, and how is that data impacting the global grain market?
Well, the data is probably poor in terms of total inventory levels, but like a lot of things, if it's the only information you have, that still ends up maybe being an important piece of information. For wheat, it's interesting because China, even though they have these huge stocks, and even though we're pretty sure that a lot of them anyway are very low quality. They don't trade a lot of wheat on the world market. They're not a huge trader. They buy some, they even sell a little bit sometimes. So they have less of a price impact than, let's say, if Russia or the EU or the US was holding all those stocks, which we know are eventually going to show up on the world market. However, China is becoming increasingly important. In fact, for soft white wheat this year, they have bought more soft white wheat than they have, I don't know, in maybe forever, but in a long time. It's coming at the expense. Maybe not at the expense. I don't know they're making this exact substitution, but at the same time, they've lowered their hard red spring wheat purchases significantly. So China right now, for a Pacific Northwest producer, looks like, hey, they're buying more than they usually do. That's a good thing. If I'm a Northeast North Dakota producer and I grow spring red, then I'm not happy because China's buying less. So on the margin for these unique varieties that they purchase, they can matter. But those are really the only two varieties they buy. So when we think about the overall world wheat price, so far, they've not been a huge impact. However, as they start to grow and their incomes go up and they start looking at for specific varieties, that all can change. My big fear with that big supply is if they just decide to dump a bunch of it, because it's expensive to hold inventories. We learned that in the 1980s in the U.S. when we were buying inventory from farmers and storing it at government expense. If they just decide it's not worth it and they dump it, it's not going to compete with white wheat in Tokyo, but it will still affect the overall world wheat price, and that could be negative. The other thing is they also have a huge supply of the world coarse grain, and they do trade coarse grains, corn, for example. And corn and wheat prices are highly linked. So anything they do there could be an issue. Think about the current trade situation. I've had people tell me, well, China doesn't really buy wheat. It doesn't matter if they put a 25% tariff. Well, it does, because if they put a 25% tariff on corn and U.S. corn exports back up, that will have a negative impact on our wheat price as well.
Interesting, interesting. So how do you make sense of the soft white shipments into China? Is this about need or is this about politics?
That's a good question, and I don't really have a good answer. I really need to sit down and talk to the Grain Commission and find out who's been buying it and exactly why they've been buying it. My guess is initially it's not politics. We're finding new demand centers and income in China is growing. The middle class is quite large and growing. And so they probably started to diversify their dietary choices similar to Korea and Japan, Japanese consumers. And my guess is it's going into products that are going to be higher quality products, more consistent products and higher priced to the consumer, and they're starting to find that they can actually sell those products in China.
We have touched on this, but explain why the corn market is so important to wheat, even though one is a feed grain and the other a food grain.
Well, first of all, we tend to think of one as a feed grain, one as a food grain, but that's not quite accurate. Some of our corn goes to Mexico, which is actually consumed as a food product in tortillas. Some of our wheat gets fed, especially soft red winter wheat when it's at relatively low quality. So there is some substitutability even between those two markets. But there's a lot of substitutability on the production side. We've already talked about North Dakota giving up wheat acres to add corn and soybean acres. Well, that's partly relatively price driven. If the price of wheat is attractive enough, I might plant wheat instead of a corn soybean rotation in North Dakota. But if corn and or soybean prices are attractive enough, I'm not going to plant wheat. I'm going to plant corn or soybeans. So those prices help drive production decisions in places where we can produce both commodities. They also, though, at some price level, become substitutes in consumption. As we mentioned before, in 2012, one of the reasons we got $9 wheat at harvest was corn got so expensive because we were concerned about pollination during July and the actual corn crop that feeders, typically with a ration that was heavy on corn, started substituting wheat into their ration to diversify away from the concern they wouldn't be able to either source corn or it was going to be too expensive. So at some point, they're actually substitutes in consumption. And for parts of the upper Midwest, the western Midwest, they're substitutes in production.
Okay, thanks. You said at the WGC meeting that corn and soybeans are both facing challenges. What are those challenges and how do they relate to wheat?
It's like wheat in this sense. We have relatively high world stocks, and these are global markets, and we have relatively high carryouts for both of those commodities. So what I was really referring to was just on the price side. Producers are not facing as attractive prices as they did 3 or 4 years ago, very similar to wheat producers. All the major grain and oilseed producers in the U.S., regardless of the crop, are facing price challenges because we simply have had some good production years, and our world competitors have had good production years. And despite growth in consumption, growth in global production has exceeded that, and that's put price pressure on all these markets.
Well, you've been watching farm bills even longer than I've been watching farm bills. In May, a farm bill vote failed in Congress. Any thoughts on how the farm bill will play out at this point?
Well, I've actually been saying since the inauguration that I thought we'd end up with an extension. And the reason was, early on, both Conaway and Peterson, so the two, you know, the Republican and the Democrat leaders of the House Ag Committee, have been optimistic since the beginning about getting a farm bill passed. The problem was early on, there was no floor time allocated to them. The Obama repeal, the tax bill, this dominated all the activity on the floor of the House. So I didn't think we would get anything. It finally got to the House, and then I thought, well, I think we'll still have an extension because it'll never get through the Senate. I was surprised it died in the House. I thought it would get through the House, and the Senate, given how tight the voting blocks are and the fact that the SNAP provisions were significantly changed, I thought they were going to lose much of their Democratic support in the Senate, and the thing wouldn't pass the Senate. I still think we're looking at an extension. I think it might be a 2-year extension, not a 1-year extension. But I guess we'll see. I just read, I guess yesterday, that they're going to try to bring the bill back to the floor of the House either this week or next week. But an immigration bill hasn't come up, so that was the Republicans' concern. They haven't addressed the SNAP provisions and backed off on the changes, which was the Democrats' concern. So I'm still not sure they can get a coalition through the House, but even if they do, if they make either one of those groups happy, then it will disrupt the situation in the Senate even more than it already is, and so I still don't think it gets through the Senate. So I think we're looking at an extension.
But you're going to have a lot of unhappy farmers because they guessed wrong on the ARC PLC.
Yeah, so this is the real question, and I don't know what the answer to this will be. I don't really have a good guess. One thing you could do is have an extension and a one-time switch. The problem with that will be this. As you know, I did a project for WAG where I showed that in 2016, farmers not being able to switch cost over $200 million in payments to farmers in Washington. That's significant. On the other hand, if you're going to extend the bill, but you're not going to increase the budget, you may not be in a position to allow the Congressional Budget Office is going to score this thing as being very expensive. The one place the last farm bill went over budget was in the ARC PLC payments already, not in the crop insurance side. It was the PLC ARC payments. So it's already over budget relative to the earlier projections for the farm bill we're in now. So from a budget perspective, it seems that it will be quite challenging to allow people to switch. On the other hand, if you want to keep peace in agriculture, that really is something that probably needs to happen in the current price environment if you're just going to extend the current legislation. But I don't really have a good idea how that will go.
Is agriculture working together with regard to the farm bill, or is it continued to be a divide and conquer kind of strategy?
Well, there's elements of both. And I think what happens is agriculture starts out sort of unified until individual details start coming out of the farm bill. How's cotton going to be treated relative to dairy, or dairy relative to specialty crops, or specialty crops relative to grains? And that's when we start to see some division. Not so much, don't do that for them, but then this is what you need to do for me. And so in this farm bill, I'm not sure we've gotten quite that far yet. We're still sort of all unified in we need a farm bill. I don't think any commodity groups have been resistant to the couple of changes in cotton and dairy that have been proposed, but we haven't really gotten down to the nitty-gritty yet where groups start pushing for one versus another kind of, like, for example, do the wheat growers want to have a more frequent opportunity to change between ARC and PLC? That hasn't really been discussed in any of the farm bill discussions. That's where we end up starting to break down across commodity groups.
You're an economist with decades of experience under your belt. Have you ever lived through a period of time where there has been as much trade hullabaloo. What period comes closest?
Yeah, I don't think I have. One thing to keep in mind is so far it's all been rhetoric and sort of pushing each other around, but not a lot of actual events that have happened, although the rhetoric has caused a lot of volatility in the markets itself. I don't remember any time where we've had this much debate. The last thing I can remember, and I wasn't a professional economist at the time, was maybe in the early 70s, the grain embargo with the Soviet Union was a large trade disruption, and it was related to other things. But if you talk about trade in general, so not just ag, you probably have to go back to about 1922 or 23 and look at that period between 1922 and 1936 where we really became sort of isolationist-focused, protectionist-focused, and we were aggressive in trying to impact trade flows through political decisions. I think you probably have to go all the way back to there to find something similar to what might end up being imposed today. Again, so far it's been mostly rhetoric, but if everybody followed through on everything they're threatening, I think we have to go back 90 to 100 years to find something similar.
So we know what happens with weather volatility. It causes market swings that farmers can take advantage of in their marketing. Is that also the case with political volatility? In other words, should we really fear political volatility, or does it give us some opportunities?
Well, both. So there are opportunities if you're willing to pull the trigger when something happens that results in a large price increase. The problem with political volatility is, unlike weather volatility, when you're in a drought, you're in a drought. So you might have a couple of days to decide, do I want to pull the trigger or not? If we say we're going to impose sanctions against picks anybody, and the price rallies, and the very next day we say we're not, which is some of what has happened to us recently, it's much more challenging to know when to pull the trigger because things are completely unpredictable. It's not like you're in a drought and you know you're going to be in a drought for at least the next week or the next 3 or 4 days. I mean, even in weather volatility, you know, we miss opportunities. But political opportunity, if the political environment is changing on a minute-by-minute or even hour-by-hour basis, the opportunities are there, but it makes it much more difficult to take advantage of them because you have no sense for when things might change.
What is your biggest fear when it comes to the soft white wheat industry in eastern Washington at this point?
I'm concerned that we don't get a price rebound quickly enough to move us from the situation we're in now. I'm actually really concerned about the trade environment. If it turns out that we can't convince customers like Japan to give us preferential tariff treatment, even though we're not part of the trade association, then we are going to be at a significant disadvantage. And while we might not lose a lot of sales this year or next year, what will happen is places like Australia will start to focus more on a more directly competing wheat that they can compete with us. They might not quite get the quality, but if they get enough of a price discount, they don't need to be quite as good as we are. And so I'm really concerned about the overall trade situation because the key to price rebounding is us being in a competitive position in the world market. Otherwise, the rest of the world might have a price rebound, and we don't experience it because we don't have access to the markets that are willing to pay those higher prices.
What do you think of Trump's suggestion that the farmers that he will come up with a program that pays the farmers for these lost markets?
I have no idea how he will do that or under what legal provision that happens. First of all, we already have a Republican Congress that's revolting over their own tax reform program because of the increase in the debt, $1.5 trillion. That's huge. Anything that he's talking about can't be paid for with current revenues, USDA monies, so there has to be some new revenue source. I have no idea where that would come from. The other thing that's a little concerning about that is almost always when we have some sort of a bailout or a help situation, it's not applied symmetrically across everybody, so there's still going to be losers. And maybe people don't even survive long enough to get whatever help he's talking about. But until I see some specificity about what this help looks like, I'm very suspicious that it actually will come forward or that it will be effective.
I don't care what side of the political aisle you're on. I thought my interview with Fortenberry was fascinating. I couldn't agree more with Fortenberry that there hasn't been a time quite like this in the agricultural world for a long, long time. And now a word. About 50% of the wheat ground in eastern Washington is owned by landlords. It's important they understand the economics of farming and the political landscape farmers operate in. Please take this opportunity to text, email, or call your landlords to let them know how to be closer to the land they own by listening to episodes 79 and 80 of Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.